Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast was originally recorded in 1987 with Barbara Brandon, author of The Passion of Ayn Rand. She discusses Rand's life and complex personality while telling of her own personal odyssey that resulted from her relationship with Rand. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
I'm Barbara Brandon. I want to talk about Ayn Rand for a lot of reasons. I don't have to tell you, I'm sure, that she's the author of Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, two novels which had very important philosophical content and which had a very profound influence on the culture in which we live. She was also an immensely fascinating woman. I wrote a book about her a year ago called The Passion of Ayn Rand. It's a biography. It includes my own relationship with her. I knew Ayn for almost 20 years, both as a close friend and as a business associate. One of the reasons I wanted to write the book, and this is relevant to what I'd like to discuss today, is that Ayn Rand was always seen by people as a symbol, even often by people who knew her fairly well. If one approved of her ideas, she was a symbol of everything that was good. If one disapproved, she was the devil incarnate. I knew for almost 20 years a fascinating, difficult, impossible, wonderful, kind, cruel human being and woman. That's who fascinated me. Of course, I was fascinated by her philosophical concepts, by her genius. But the human being was immensely interesting and immensely real. And that's the focus of my book, because it's important. I wanted, what I hope to achieve through the book, is to have people understand that this was neither goddess nor devil, but a real person who lived, who faced all the problems that all of us face, perhaps more because she was doing something very difficult. She was presenting new ideas in a hostile culture, so she ran into great opposition, but essentially faced the problems we all face in life and dealt with some of them well and with some of them badly, as we all do. She was a person, and that's what I wanted to show.
And here, the title of your book, The Passion of Ayn Rand, suggests, I think, some of what you're interested in talking about. Barbara, you met Ayn in 1950.
That's right. Yes.
Tell us about Barbara Brandon's life before 1950.
Barbara Brandon's life before 1950 was, I was born in Winnipeg, Canada, which is about the best one can say about Winnipeg, is that it's very, very cold. And as soon as I could crawl, I think I was heading out. Now there are a lot of things about Winnipeg I like. As a young person, I didn't. And I wanted to go to the United States, where things happened. I went to UCLA in 1950 to study philosophy. I had known even then that I wanted to be a writer, but I thought philosophy would be the subject that would teach me the things I wanted to know in order to write the way I wanted to write. And it was there that I met Ayn, who was living in Los Angeles with her husband, Frank O'Connor, and was working on Atlas Shrugged. She was about one third of the way through it. At the time, I was friendly with a man who later became my husband, still later became my ex-husband, Nathaniel Brandon. He wrote Ayn a fan letter. He and I were both devoted to The Fountainhead. It had been very important in both our lives. And as a result of a letter he wrote her asking questions, the three of us met. And it was the beginning of, we began as students, as proteges, just devouring the things she had to say. I'll speak for myself, not for Nathaniel. I was dealing in those teenage years with, I guess, the problems we all deal with in those years. What's the meaning of life? Is there free will? What's morality? What's good and bad? How should I live? All the confusions, all the issues that a young person deals with. And along came a small woman with a foreign accent who spoke exquisitely, brilliantly, and appeared to have the answers to the questions I'd been tormenting myself with for years. I had always read every book I could get my hands on. I couldn't find any answers in those books. I couldn't figure them out for myself.
Did you have a hero before Ayn Rand came into your life?
A personal hero? I had a literary hero, who was Thomas Wolfe. That was the first writer I discovered. No, I didn't have... Oh, well, yes. I must say I did have a hero. Tarzan. That was my great childhood hero. But real people, no, except for writers. They were my heroes.
Who before Rand had the most significant influence on your life?
Oh, Thomas Wolfe by far. He had a very deep influence on my life. I have felt, and feel to this day in a way, when I read him that there are ways in which I'm hearing my own voice. There's a lot of things about his books I don't care for. He wrote Look Homeward, Angel, You Can't Go Home Again, etc. But there's a sort of lushness about his style and a passionate commitment to life that has always been wonderful to me. And I felt as I was 12 years old when I first read his books, and I felt like they had opened the world to me, that he made me aware of possibilities that I hadn't dreamed of before. It was very important and very valuable for me.
Would you please define the terms conservative and liberal, and mm-hmm. tell us where you place yourself politically?
All right. As a matter of fact, I'll paraphrase Ayn, who said something brilliant on that phenomenon. She considered that in certain crucial ways, conservatives and liberals are alike. She said that liberals want man's mind to be free. That is, they're opposed to censorship. In the whole realm of ideas, they believe in free choice, completely free choice. But they want to enslave the material world. They want government to run, other people to run, or to make the decisions for how man conducts his business, his material life. So they will leave his soul free, but imprison his body. And she said that the conservatives are in exactly the opposite camp. That is, that the conservatives want censorship, many of them, most of them in some ways. They want man to follow their morality, to believe in their God, but they will allow his body to be free. They will shackle his mind and leave his body free. If that definition is valid, and I think it is, I'm neither a liberal nor a conservative. There I am, and there are ways over the years in which I have found myself in disagreement with Ayn Rand. On these issues, not at all. She was dedicated to laissez-faire capitalism. That is, complete economic freedom, complete intellectual freedom, complete freedom, hands off. And there I would agree with her completely.
You met Nathaniel in Winnipeg.
Yes, I did.
Was it a coincidence that you both attended UCLA, or did you decide to go there?
Not quite a coincidence. Our meeting was strange. We were about 17 years old. Nathaniel's from Toronto, but he had come to Winnipeg for a year between high school and university. And I met him because a friend of mine said to me one day, there's a young man from out of town whom you must meet. He's the only person who talks about the Fountainhead the way you do. And that's how we met. And he did talk about the Fountainhead the way I did. And that was the basis of a friendship, which was later to become a marriage. I had initially decided to go to UCLA, and his decision, I believe, followed that. But we did go together.
Mm-hmm. Nathaniel took you to meet Ayn. You mentioned
that. Yes, he did. Yes.
And that was his second meeting with her.
Yes, it was.
in the book, you present it as a very magical evening. Tell us more about it.
About his first evening?
No, about your first evening.
It was pure magic. One of the things that was so astonishing to me, I was a very shy girl. I did not talk to people easily unless they were people I was close to, and then it was very difficult to stop me talking. But I was shy with strangers. Now I was meeting a woman I had adored from reading The Fountainhead and We the Living and Anthem. And though I was shy during the evening and did not speak terribly much, I will never forget the feeling I had of, I'm safe, it's okay here. Because what I felt was, I'm in the presence of a person who will never be unreasonable. Whatever she does, whatever she doesn't do, whatever she says, I will understand and there will be reasons for it. I felt like I'm dealing with the totally intelligible and there's no problems there. The magic apart from that for me was simply listening to her talk on all sorts of subjects. Nathan and I had endless numbers of questions about everything from free will to politics to who was running for Congress to our classes at school. And Ian had a capacity to listen that was wonderful. You really were heard. And then out would come in long, careful detail, always explained very carefully, always at a level at which we could grasp it, the answers to these questions that we had never found a philosopher who could answer. At least so it seemed to us.
Do you still feel the same way about that evening and about Ian after all the events that have transpired since?
Well, that evening will always remain as magical. That whole first period will always remain as magical. It was like, it was utopian. It was days and weeks and months of being like a sponge, simply being filled up with the most fascinating concepts, and more than even the specific concepts, with what seemed to me a way to make the world intelligible. I've never known quite how one defines genius, but what I discovered with Ayn Rand is that when you're with a genius, you know it. One knew immediately, and I'm not the only one. Almost anyone who met her, I think, would say the same thing. One knows this is not just a brilliant mind. This is not just an extraordinary mind. This is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. This is genius. This is something very rare and very special. And the magic of being taught by such a mind, I will never forget. As the years went by, the progress really was my becoming more and more committed to her ideas in a way that ultimately was not healthy. She had, in my view, been right so many times that ultimately, even when she said something or would hold a view that bothered me, that something inside me was saying no to, it was Ayn Rand who was saying it, and I would try to accept it. And that's a very unhealthy state. It was ultimately reached almost a guru state of affairs. But as the years followed that state, I began to recognize that there are things I can't accept, there are things I don't like, there are things that go very much against the grain. And I began very gradually pulling away. Pulling away, not in the sense of our friendship, but in my own head, beginning to think for myself once more, not to be rigidly held within the perimeters that Ian had established. And that led ultimately to a break.
She was certainly a person of very strongly held views.
Yes.
Generally, we accept that in someone.
Yes,
but we're not necessarily as pleased when someone's intolerant of other people's ideas.
Yes.
Was that a part of Ayn's personality?
Yes, it was in the later years of her life. It's very unfortunate. I have often felt that people who met Ayn in, say, in the mid-60s, the 60s, the 70s, never really knew the Ayn that I knew in the 50s. A certain intolerance was evident in her from the beginning. A certain moralism was evident in her from the beginning. But they weren't sharply focused. They were rare. One saw evidence of them rarely. What one saw most of the time was a woman of infinite charm, of great kindness, of a desire to help people she cared about, to help them intellectually, infinite patience in explaining things. She loved it, as she was a born teacher. What I saw happen over the years, as her own life grew more difficult, and though she was certainly enormously successful as a writer, the opposition in intellectual circles was savage, opposition to her ideas, and very painful to her. I saw a growing bitterness as the years passed, which tended to increase that intolerance, increase the moralizing, increase her sense that she was alone in a hostile universe. And there was a great personality change over the years, which was painfully sad to see.
When you met Ayn, she was writing Atlas Shrugged at that
time.
Yes,
she was.
And her years of struggle for survival had ended with the publication of Fountainhead. That's, I think, a reasonably fair statement.
Yes, it is.
How did you acquire your knowledge about Ayn's life prior to Atlas Shrugged, prior to you meeting her?
Well, two ways. In the early 60s, Nathaniel and I put out a little book called Who is Ayn Rand? And my part, it was, excuse me, four essays. Nathaniel did three of them, and I did a short biographical sketch of Ayn, which slightly embarrasses me now. It was done totally honestly. The way I wrote about her was the way I saw her. But that wasn't a human being I was writing about. It was a goddess. I can only say that's how I saw her at the time. But in order to do, I needed then information about her early life, clearly, and asked if I could interview her on tape. She said yes, and the interviews began to get away from us. And instead of simply giving me the very limited amount of material that I needed for a brief sketch, we ultimately ended up doing 20 taping sessions, each one of them a minimum of 2 hours, in which she told me all about her life in Russia all the way through. And what was especially marvelous was she told me not only what happened, but what it meant to her, what she felt, what she concluded, what hurt and what gave her pleasure. So it was very rich and full. That was part of the research. When I came to do The Passion of Ayn Rand, I had those tapes. But I knew that it was necessary to get much more material. I couldn't simply repeat the story Ayn had told me, although it contained invaluable material. I then decided I had to become a private detective without portfolio, which I did, and began hunting down people who, family members, there was no one who had known her in Russia, but there were family members here who had come from Russia, had known the family, had kept in touch with them on and off over the years, and who had looked after Ayn when she first came to the United States at the age of 21. So they knew a good deal about her family, about her growing up. I found someone when Ayn first came to Hollywood, still 21 years old, determined to be a screenwriter, although she barely spoke English at that time. She stayed at a wonderful place called the Hollywood Studio Club. It's a it doesn't exist anymore, but it was a home for young women attempting to get into some branch of the movie business. And it didn't cost much, and the girls helped each other. It was a wonderful place. It's been written about a lot. I found two people who had been at the Hollywood Studio Club during the 2 years Ian lived there. And so with this, with her family members, with other people who had known her in that early period, with the search for documents, I mean, I found her wedding license, which interestingly enough lists as her profession, waitress. I found all sorts of documents. All of this filled in the picture for me. And I did speak to a sister still living in Russia, not too satisfactorily, but I was able to contact her.
Of course, Ian's husband you knew well in person.
Oh, yes, indeed.
In your book, my sense was that Frank seemed emotionally and intellectually rather bland, almost an isolated person.
Frank was very isolated. I wouldn't say bland. I loved Frank very much. He was so good a man that in all the research I did for this book, and I talked to over 200 people, I have never heard one negative word said about Frank. He was a very easy man to love, very gentle, very kind, but no match for Ian, as nobody was. And the life kind of went out of him over the years. He had wanted to be an actor, that didn't work out. And his life more and more as the years went by simply revolved around Ian, which was not what he had wanted, which was not what he had intended, but she was so powerful a person that without wishing to dominate him, and certainly without telling him what he must do, he began to follow in her wake, which was terribly destructive for him, and he was very alone through all of this.
And at the same time, Ian, strong, forceful, seemed to be equally isolated.
Much more so in many ways, particularly as the years went by. It was an interesting contradiction, which perhaps is not fully a contradiction. Ian truly, authentically believed that man's natural state is to be happy, that's what comes easiest to human beings, that she believed that if you use your mind, if you try to understand the world, if you think about what you're doing, make conscious decisions, it's true a bomb can drop on your head, which isn't in your control. But by and large, you will lead a happy life. However, she came to feel, and she didn't say these words, but this was clearly what was happening. She came to feel about herself, particularly after Atlas Shrugged, for reasons that I will explain. That she was getting so little back from the world, that she had worked tremendously hard, had produced what she knew to be a superb book, and though it was selling incredibly, as a parenthesis, I was in a bookstore in New York recently on Fifth Avenue, which had in the front of the store a rack of paperbacks, and the heading was New Bestsellers, and one of them was Atlas Shrugged, which came out in 1957. So she never had any objection to the sales of her books. What upset her tremendously was that there was no response, no favorable response from people she would consider her peers. She was inundated with fan mail. I mean, you could barely walk into her study. It was simply floor-to-ceiling fan mail, which did not ever stop coming. But what she wanted most of all was someone of recognized stature in her field, in some field, to stand up for her publicly and name the accomplishment contained in Atlas Shrugged. And there wasn't one. And that progressively gave her the sense, who am I writing for? Who's out there? I've given everything I've got to give. And I'm not getting back anything on a level that really matters to me. They were very despairing, very unhappy years after Atlas Shrugged. Well, compounded by disasters in her personal life.
Why was no one willing to acknowledge her contribution?
Well, a lot of young people were, and a lot of not so young people, but they were not recognized names. I think I understand her pain, and I certainly shared some of it. I felt almost at times as though Atlas Shrugged were partly mine. I was so close to the writing of it and so close to her. In a way, it felt almost like it's my book out in the world. Well, the reviews were awful. I've never seen such bad reviews. But as I look back on it now, Ian had said that she was challenging the cultural tradition of 2,500 years, which in certain ways she was doing. One cannot expect that, in effect, the entrenched intelligentsia, who have every vested interest in that cultural tradition, will drop all their ideas and embrace someone who was saying the exact opposite. Perhaps it's too much to expect. There is a certain logic in it not happening. But it was very painful for Ian. I've seen this changing in the years since. I think today, were she alive, she would be much more likely to get what she wanted. I mean, she is getting it. But as with so many great creators, after her death, not before.
It seems as if it's taken a while for people to sort out the hardcore philosophical base of her ideas and
yes,
begin to consider them seriously.
Yes, it is unfortunate. Ian always said that when she was 80, she would write a nonfiction treatise on her philosophy, but she didn't get to be 80. And so one has to pick it out of, she wrote nonfiction, but never a definitive treatise on the whole of her philosophy. So one picks it out of her nonfiction and out of her novels, which is not as satisfactory as it could have been.
In a recent speech, Leonard Peikoff, who is Ian's heir,
yes,
said that she was used by those whom she thought were her friends. In reading your book, the feeling I had was that she did not hesitate to use others. Would you please comment on both of those views?
Yes, I will. I do not believe that Ian was used by people. At least not that I ever saw. I mean, of course people were drawn to her because she was famous and in that sense would have used her. But they never got near her if that was their motivation. She was very fast at knowing whether someone is truly interested in her ideas or simply wants to meet a celebrity. And if it were the second, they were forgotten in a minute and did not get inside her living room. No, I can't say she was used. Nor would I say that she used people as a part of her character. There were times when it happened. But if she wanted something very desperately and it required asking something of someone that she perhaps shouldn't have asked, she would ask it if she were able to convince herself that it was okay. But she wouldn't consciously use people. She gave a great deal. The young people around her who were her friends, she gave enormously philosophically. But they worked very hard. They did a great many things for her. They attempted to spread her ideas. I have to say that Nathaniel and I Ayn, until we formed our lecture institute, which was called Nathaniel Brandon Institute, we formed this shortly after Atlas Shrugged came out. And ultimately, we're giving series of lectures on Ayn Rand's philosophy in New York and in 80 cities around the country. That had a very positive effect in the sense of making Ayn seen not only as a fiction writer, but as a philosopher, because that's what our lectures were focusing on. So that in that sense, I think we contributed a great deal to her work and her career. There's no question she contributed an immense amount to our philosophical development. I think it was a pretty fair trade. And that was so with most of the people she knew.
I've been surprised at the intellectual intolerance of some of Rand's followers. I understand they've refused to read your book, and they've urged others not to read it. How would Ayn have reacted, both to their position and to your book?
Well, I don't quite know how she would have reacted to their position, because much as I wish it were otherwise, I believe she would not have liked my book. It took me a long time to recognize Ayn as a human being. I kind of knew she was sensed and reacted as if she were a woman from the beginning. That aspect of her, I was somehow keyed into from very early. And I think that was partly the basis of our closeness, that I did understand her in that respect. But there was still very much the temptation to see her as a goddess, as something so much larger than life, that she was not quite of this earth. Ayn did the same thing about Ayn Rand, not in the way I did, but she, with her growing intolerance, one form it took was she would not consider the possibility that she was wrong in any of her ideas. She had worked tremendously hard and tremendously conscientiously to develop her ideas, but that doesn't guarantee total success. So the intolerance did grow. I don't think she would have liked the fact that I say certain of her ideas I don't agree with, though I am in agreement with the fundamentals of objectivism. She would not have liked the fact that I say she had psychological problems. She stated many times she did not have any psychological problems and never had had. So that she would not have been thrilled with my book. Nor do I think she would have approved of the sort of nonsense that's going on with this, what is really a handful of her followers. I mean, to write a statement, as one of them did, that no one concerned with Ayn Rand's ideas should read my book. In effect, it's inaccurate, he understands. It's factually inaccurate. It's philosophically inaccurate. As for himself, he hasn't read it and doesn't intend to. Ayn would not have denounced a book that she hadn't read and would not approve of that.
That would be my perception also.
Yes.
Can we really separate Ayn's ideas from her life?
No. Yes and no. Ayn believed, truly authentically believed, that during her entire life, she had remained committed to a certain set of ideas and had never betrayed them. My own view is that in so many, so very important ways, that's true. She was a woman of enormous honor, all the virtues of a Howard Roark in the sense of dedication to her work, the ability to go on despite whatever odds there were. And she had odds and difficulties quite as awful as Howard Roark's, perhaps harder. But she was a fighter. She was impossible for her to give in, ever to compromise, to do less than her best work. The dynamism, the dedication was worthy of the best of her heroes. Her human relationships were something quite different. That was a realm that I don't think she thought about much. And there were a lot of problems her whole life in that area. She was not good. She didn't understand people. And in her dealings with human beings, I don't think she fully understood herself. I know she didn't fully understand herself, her own motivation in a lot of respects. So that in that sense, one could say, but I wouldn't, that she contradicted her philosophy. But I wouldn't, because that's not really what was involved. She was a woman driven in certain respects by motivation she didn't understand, as we all are.
Well, the impression I have of Rand, from your book, from people who know her, etc., was she was very harsh, difficult to get along with.
Yes.
And that is, I assume, accurate.
Yes, in her later years, yes.
Is it accurate that in order to win her lasting favor, you had to somehow abandon all of your own personality? You had to kind of give up your own existence?
No, not really. Many of us did so. The force of that personality was enormous. Nobody ever decided to do so. It was the sort of situation in which one might discover that's what's been happening, and I hadn't noticed. What I required was only this, which was a lot, but this is where it began and ended. If you raised a question, if there was an issue you wanted to understand about her ideas, or if you disagreed, which was fine, you had to be willing to talk until it was resolved. And if she was convinced and you were convinced that she had given you an unanswerable argument which made sense to you, then you had to say you accepted it and act accordingly, live according to it. But she didn't require that people approach her agreeing with everything she said or agree without hearing the whole case. She had immense patience and was willing to explain endlessly. But once the explanation was given and her listener and questioner was satisfied, then she would be tremendously intolerant of what she would see as a deviation from that acceptance. And the roof would come down.
What do you think was the most important idea that Ayn Rand had from a layman's point of view?
Oh, I think certainly from a layman's point of view, it's her moral philosophy. The whole concept of man's right to live for his own happiness, which has not been said before, that that's a moral right, that man's happiness is a virtue, not just something, well, if you do good to others, it's okay to be a little happy. But she was enormously inspiring to young people because of that, and to not young people, but particularly the young, who were brought up as we're all brought up, that to push down the I now and then, a little bit or a lot. And Ayn came along and said, to live for your own rational happiness is a great virtue. To pursue the things you want in the world is a great virtue. And the idealism of this approach, the emphasis on reason, I think these are the things that were so important and that will make her immortal.
You were introduced to Ayn by reading The Fountainhead.
That's right, yes.
And then you met her in person and you knew her well when Atlas Shrugged was published.
Yes.
How do you relate those two books?
It's an interesting question. I think that Atlas Shrugged is by far the greater book in its complexity, in its plot, in its philosophical intricacy. It's an incredible work. There are ways in which, personally, I prefer The Fountainhead. What I see in Atlas Shrugged is the signs of the bitterness growing. There's a lot of anger in Atlas Shrugged, which is much less so in The Fountainhead, much less so in We the Living than in The Fountainhead, even though We the Living was written about her life in Soviet Russia. But one can see in her work the bitterness increasing. And the anger in Atlas Shrugged, I don't enjoy. Much as I admire the book, and there are sections of it that I think there are sections of it that are brilliant and that I've read many times, and I enjoy reading it. But there's a certain very personal pleasure I get from The Fountainhead, perhaps because that was the first one. Perhaps because that was the one that opened so many doors for me when I was 15 years old, that it has a special meaning to me. I'm not sure how objective I am.
A reader of Atlas Shrugged suggested to me that there's a shift of tone in Atlas Shrugged. The way it was stated was that about a third of the way into the book, there's a more strident, harder line that appears. And was there anything in Ian's life that occurred that would have thrown her in that direction?
Yes, there were things occurring in Ian's life, but not that would have thrown her in that direction. No, I'm not aware of this, what this man said about the book, that the tone changes.
But you do feel it's more strident than
than The Fountainhead, yes. But that's there pretty much from the beginning. I think, now let me really focus on this. Yes, I think it's true. I don't know what section I would choose. But Ian did grow more bitter even during the years of working on Atlas Shrugged. And that would have had to show. I mean, the writer's life can never be irrelevant to the writing. And especially in the sense of a view of the world changing, that or refocusing or shifting slightly. It wasn't that it completely changed. So yes, it probably, what startled me is that you said a third of the way along, and I was, but yes, as it continues, and as she deals more and more with the villains, it does become angrier, yes. That's true.
In introducing the book to a young reader, mm-hmm. how would you prepare them for the book?
For
Atlas Shrugged?
Well, I wouldn't start a young reader with Atlas Shrugged. I would definitely suggest The Fountainhead first, and then Atlas Shrugged. But I think I would want to tell them that there is a certain bitterness in Atlas Shrugged that they may not like, but that it's such a great book, they must read it. But I would prefer to start with The Fountainhead, and I do that when I'm asked. I do always recommend The Fountainhead first.
In reading Atlas Shrugged, would you recommend that people wade through the long speeches? I had a tendency to skip them and come back.
Well, do you know, unless one is specifically interested in abstract philosophical issues, I grant you the very long speech at the end of the book is a little much. But some of the speeches earlier in the book, which are not nearly that long, are wonderful and exciting. There is a speech one of her heroes makes about the nature of money that is one of the most intellectually exciting things I've ever read in my life to this day. It's only, I think, the last one that is too abstract, really, for fiction. Ian pretty much knew that, but felt it was necessary to include that material. It's very technical. It's very difficult for someone who picks up a novel. For someone who isn't a trained philosopher.
Did Ian have to really battle with the publishers to get them to leave in that long section at the end?
Well, not exactly. What Ian tended to simply say where publishers were concerned was, no. And that was about it. She was not about to make changes. Ian felt with Atlas Shrugged quite differently than she'd felt with earlier books. She had an editor for The Fountainhead, whom she respected, who made suggestions that she liked very much, whom she felt was very helpful. By the time she completed Atlas Shrugged, she felt she was so much a professional writer, so much in control of what she was doing, that she was not interested in an editor's opinions. She did not think an editor was likely to know better than she knew at that point how something should be done. So for all practical purposes, Atlas Shrugged was not edited by an editor. It was by Ian.
The word selfishness,
mm-hmm.
very important in mm-hmm. Ian's ideas.
Yes.
And it seems to me somewhat responsible for some of the antagonism toward her was that here was this person that was putting selfishness on a pedestal, rather.
She wrote a book called The Virtue of Selfishness. Do you know, I know why she did it, and I feel a lot of sympathy for that. It was the principle of, if this is treason, make the most of it. She was not going to, and this would it would be so untypical of Ian, to try to find a way to make her ideas palatable by attempting to make them sound like everyone else's ideas, at least in part. If she believed in the right to pursue one's rational self-interest, which she did, and if some people would say, oh my God, that's selfishness, she would say, okay, then we'll call it selfishness. And that's what I'm defending. Now, it certainly was not selfishness in the sense of the term, which means you trample on other people to get what you want. That she was tremendously opposed to that. But she used the word deliberately defiantly, simply because she wanted to stress, yes, you live for your own self-interest. That's the primary, that's the moral.
A quote from Ian on that subject.
Mm-hmm.
The attack on selfishness is an attack on man's self-esteem. Mm-hmm. To surrender one is to surrender the other.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. If you don't live for your own goals, for your own purposes, which means for the things that are important to you in life, then what will you base a self-esteem? If you follow other people, if you give up the things you want, for whatever reason, but your life is a series of giving up what you want and not pursuing it, not selfishly pursuing goals that matter to you, how will you ever like yourself? It's not possible. Self-esteem is immensely important to psychological health. And immensely important to self-esteem is knowing that one has the courage and the will to go after what one wants. But if one decides to follow Ayn Rand blindly and live for her or for one's elderly mother or whatever it may be, you will have the very unpleasant, really ugly feeling of, my life's going by. None of the things I want am I pursuing. I'm not much.
Within this emphasis on personal development, individual mm-hmm. development, what were Ian's views on the family?
Interesting. Ian believed very strongly that there can be no unchosen obligations. That is, she believed that that the mother and father certainly have obligations to the child because they brought the child into the world. But she did not believe that you were required to love your cousins, your aunts, your uncles, even your parents. She believed that love was something one earned by qualities of character, by qualities of mind. And the fact that you were someone's child or someone's niece or someone's granddaughter, that by itself did not mean that there was any reason to love them. That love had to be earned always. I can't say I think it's quite that simple, but this was definitely her view. She certainly believed in marriage, but that was chosen. That was two people loving each other, deciding they wish to be together for the rest of their lives. As far as I've often been asked, why didn't Ayn have children? There were two reasons, and the first really makes this second not very important. She never wanted children. It wasn't that she disliked them or that she was opposed to children, but it simply was not something. She was totally consumed by her own career, by the things she wanted to achieve as a writer and as a philosopher. And I don't think children was an issue that ever really came up in her mind. It was not a desire of hers. Also, had she wanted them when she and Frank were married, it would have been very destructive for her. She was then, and for years, working full-time, trying to write The Fountainhead and other works. If she'd had a child, that would have all been impossible, and she knew that. But the crucial reason is she didn't want to have children.
In the current state of world affairs, there's another aspect of Ayn's life that is extremely relevant. Mm-hmm. That's both her background in coming from the Soviet Union and her attitude yes. toward both Soviet communism and Nazi fascism. Mm-hmm. And could you comment on that? It seemed to be a very central part of her life. She was very concerned about it.
Oh, yes, indeed. Ayn was 12 years old when she saw in Petrograd the first shots of the Russian Revolution. And then, as a young girl, until she was 21 years old, she lived through those early terrible days of communism, which is not to say the later days weren't terrible. But she lived through civil war, through starvation, terror, everything that went with that. And remarkably, for a young girl, but this is typical of the things that were remarkable about Ayn. She understood even then that the reasons for the shooting down of innocent people, the reasons for the hunger, the reason for the terror, was not simply a gang of thugs. It was the posters those thugs lined Petrograd with. Posters saying man must live for the state. Man must live for something higher than himself. Man exists to serve his brothers. She knew it was the ideas that were responsible for the horror she was seeing in life. And she knew that those ideas were the heart of communism. When, years later, she began to learn about fascism, what she understood that most people don't understand to this day is that it's identical with communism. Only a few of the concretes are different. Hitler also said, man must live for a higher purpose. Man must live for the state. Slightly different kind of state, slightly different kind of brothers, but still, the one absolute in any totalitarian state is man must not be allowed to live for himself. We can't rule such men. He must live for the state, for his brothers, for all of them put together, for whatever we find for him to live for. Because once we allow him to pursue his own personal happiness, we can't control him. And she understood always that communism and fascism are the same thing, with slightly different names and a couple of different concretes, but no real distinction between them.
She would then be appalled with the current, quote, negotiations and the attempt to strike a bargain with the Soviets?
Yes, she would think it was useless. It isn't that she would be appalled because they're communists and we shouldn't deal with them. That would be part of it. I don't know what she would say today. I can't be positive. But during the years I knew her, her strong conviction was we should not deal with them. We should not sanction murderers by having anything to do with them. And that we should not deal with them economically. Let not help them in any way. Let them sink all by themselves. not send them wheat, not send them anything. She wanted simply no contact. And she felt that was the form an act of war against the Soviet Union should take if we were to win that war.
The Ayn Rand Institute, from some things I've read, seems to go out of its way to attack almost every point of view except the objectivist. I've read articles they've written against the conservatives, the liberals, the libertarians, etc. Is objectivism totally alien to all these other groups?
No, it's not. And it's pointless. I think there seems to be, it's a very small group of people we're talking about who mostly talk to each other, which I'm glad of, who have appear to me to have taken Ayn's sense of being in a hostile universe to an incredible extreme and seem determined to prove by denouncing everybody and everything that they are lonely martyrs fighting for a lost cause. Well, it isn't a lost cause, and they don't have to be martyrs, and they don't have to be lonely, but that's what they're creating, totally unnecessarily.
What would be your advice to the parties of the right, if you would, the groups I've mentioned, the libertarians, the classical liberals, the conservatives, how might they benefit from objectivism? And do you have any sense as to how we can present the common aspects of these various points of view to the general public?
Oh, dear. That's an enormous question. I think there are ways in which there are not common aspects. In what I said before, there are certainly liberals and Ayn Rand have something in common. Conservatives and Ayn Rand have something in common. But the differences are enormous in the sense of that I quoted her earlier as saying the conservatives don't want freedom of the mind, the liberals don't want material freedom. As long as that remains, there cannot be a meeting of the minds. They can see, many of them do see, great values in Ayn Rand. But when it comes, Ayn's political principle, the base of her political philosophy was, no man may initiate force against any other man. For any reason, for any cause, neither the conservatives nor the liberals accept that. And to that extent, there's no way of coming together. I think the way that Ayn Rand's ideas, if one wishes to spread them the way it has to be done, is as it is being done by people recommending her books, by people studying them, looking for other material that will be similar and reading that. But the old line entrenched conservatives and liberals will not be very good ground for that. It's young people. It's each new generation of college students who rediscovers Ayn Rand. And I have heard, I would say over the years, and this is a conservative estimate, I have heard 2,000 people say to me, Ayn Rand changed my life. And I believe it. Those are the people who are beginning to teach in universities, are functioning well in all sorts of fields. They will create a change. One won't create the change, and they have been creating a change. One won't create it by going to the traditional conservatives and liberals. They're glued very tight to their perspectives. Most of them, of course, there are exceptions.
And what's the next step for Barbara Brandon?
For Barbara Brandon, it's to write a novel, a love story, which I'm starting to plot, and I hope to be working on this fall, and I'm looking forward to it enormously. I've wanted to do it for years, and it really excites me.
Thank you.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.